You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Sally Thomas has represented the Samuel Miller District since 1994, when she first won election to the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors in 1993 as an independent write-in candidate over Carter Myers. Ms. Thomas has served a total of 16 years on the board. Ms. Thomas spoke at the January 13, 2010 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia, held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. The event was moderated by SSV Secretary Bill Davis.
Well, it's my true pleasure and honor to introduce Sally Thomas. I think probably everyone in this room knows her. She's represented the Samuel Miller District on the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors for 16 years. She came off this year. After those 16 years, she was elected to the board in 1993 by a write-in vote, which is really quite an accomplishment. In fact, she won by 192 votes. And I see Madison back there grinning, probably saying I should have done a write-in. But she served the county for all that term. Sally grew up in Oregon. She has a BA and an MAT from Harvard at Radcliffe in government and education. They've been in Charlottesville since 1963. Before she was elected to the board of supervisors, she was a director of governmental and community relations at UVA. She served on the Albemarle County Board of School Board and has been the president of the local League of Women Voters. In 1994, she was selected as Virginia Women's Forum Woman of the Year in Leadership Charlottesville, the Leader's Leader in 2001. She had gubernatorial appointments to the Chesapeake Bay Program's Local Government Advisory Commission, the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, and the Natural Resources Partnership. She has a wonderful record of community and statewide service. Now, I'm not going to read you all the boards and commissions that she's been involved with. She'd only have 5 minutes left to speak to us. But I thought the most interesting part of her resume is she's also a graduate of the Albemarle County Citizens Police Academy. Well, my wife is a graduate of the Police Academy, and Sally, I don't know about your husband, but ever since I learned that about Gene Acton, I've really been very careful in watching what I do. So without further ado, it's really indeed my honor and my pleasure to introduce Sally Thomas.
Let me spend just a minute getting this right. Well, I'll just stand up taller. Thank you very much for that introduction. I was hoping you wouldn't read all of it. And thanks for having me here. Yeah, that would be nice. There we go. Much nicer. Okay, don't have to stand on my tiptoes. I'm really honored to be here, and I'm delighted that there is such a group as the Senior Statesmen. You bring a kind of dialogue and opportunity to the community that was really needed, and I'm really glad you're here. And the fact that you're here shows that you're interested in government. I had majored in government in college, as was pointed out, so I had a long-standing interest in how government works. And when we came to town in the 1960s, the League of Women Voters was about the only game in town for a woman who wanted to learn about and participate in local government. Some of you will remember those days. We young brides, young people today don't believe me when I tell them this story, but we young brides in those days didn't want to bore our husbands. And so we looked for things to do to be able to keep ourselves interested and our husbands too. I was working at UVA's Graduate School of Business Administration, and I joined some civil rights groups and the League of Women Voters. By 1990, I had served a term on the school board, and I was president of the League, and in a position to urge its members to get involved in local government in any way they could. And to make it more daring, I called it infiltration. I said, we've got to infiltrate these government boards, commissions, and I still urge that upon citizens. But that's where the first use of the word infiltration comes in, and why I put it on the title of this little talk. It has to do with participation in government, but that's not always the same as politics. I think politics is a means to an end, but the end is having a government that does the right thing as determined by citizens. I despair of young students of politics these days, because they often think winning an election is the end goal and forget the rest of the challenge, which is how to govern well. But first I'll talk about the political thing that got me elected, because I suspect that's the unusual part of my story. It's been 16 years, so not everyone here remembers how it was done. It was September 7th, 1993, 7 weeks before Election Day, when in a friend's living room, a bunch of people gathered and asked me to run for the Board of Supervisors. I warned them that it would be hard work, and conventional wisdom says you can't win a write-in, which is what it was going to have to be, because there was only one name on the ballot. The member of the Board of Supervisors had withdrawn his name too late for anyone else's name to be on the ballot. The Samuel Miller District had been pro-schools, anti-growth, and anti-29 bypass pretty consistently, and the name on the ballot seemed to favor the opposite. And also, the Board of Supervisors, if you haven't noticed, has 6 members, which means it could easily get a tie vote of 3-3, but for many years it was balanced. Those 3-3 votes split on pro, anti-growth, and also on pro and anti-budget, but it wasn't always the same 3 people. But it had been a very balanced board, and an election of someone who changed the direction that the Samuel Miller District had usually gone in was going to make a drastic change. So the balance of the board was hanging, and it seemed like it was important to get at least some dialogue going in the community. I agreed to do it because I cared a lot, and I had that old League of Women Voters message of do your homework and then act. And it seemed like it was a good time to act, but I didn't think I could win. Everyone agrees, write-in campaigns are impossible. We had to teach people how to write in, as well as all the other tasks of a campaign. We had 7 weeks. Writing in is tricky. It takes 2 hands. You had to push a button, slide open a door, and it had to be the correct door, and then you had to write in the name with a pencil, and you had to spell it correctly. So there were all those challenges, and most people had never done a write-in. We didn't have my name, on the ballot, and so organizations like the League of Women Voters' policy was that you couldn't come to their candidates' forum, because if you weren't on the ballot, you weren't a real candidate. But the major issue was that we also couldn't beg, borrow, or steal the voter registration list. So we had no way of contacting the voters. And the only thing we could do was sit in the voter registrar's office and get people with their laptops and type for 5 solid days. A dozen or so people sat in the voter registrar's office and copied the registrar's list. You couldn't even take it out of the room to a Xerox machine. You had to sit there and do that. But that was kind of an indication of the kind of devotion to the campaign that we found among volunteers. We, among other volunteers, we had one who in Chicago used to do the Nike and State Farm ads. So he was not an amateur like most of us were, but he agreed to do our television ads. My favorite one was one that he didn't actually help with. A campaign worker and I went to a young man who was making educational videos and asked if he'd make a 30-second spot for the campaign. This had been a hot and heavy campaign season. TV stations were full of lots of talking heads and blasting at you every time you turned on your TV. So he pulled out a few slides and a few sound bites, and soon we had an ad that I've never seen duplicated. It was just a pretty picture of the mountains. Silence. You can imagine the impact of silence after your eardrums had been assailed by the political talking heads. Silence. A rooster crows in the background. Silence. And then a voice comes on right at the very end, saying something like, "When you go to vote, remember the beauty of our landscape and write in Sally Thomas." I have no idea if it was an ad that had any impact on anyone, but it's been one of my favorites. So after 7 weeks of stuffing newspaper tubes and all the other things that you do, we wrote individual thank you letters to more than 300 people. So when you think that grassroots is dead, that at least was a time when it really was a grassroots campaign. Election day, I didn't think we'd win. I expected I would feel bad about all that effort that everyone had put in, but it would have been a good show and would have been a discussion of issues and given people a choice they otherwise wouldn't have had. I had a speech in my head along those lines. To vote, you had to not only do all this, but you had to step over to the left and do all this. Jim asked me not to step away from the microphone here, but you had to step over to the left. So I went and visited all the polling places, and I would see underneath the curtains, I would see feet stepping over to the left, stepping over to the left. And then the voting machine started running out of paper, because paper's only used for write-ins, and so the voting machines aren't usually loaded with very much paper. And I can still take you to the spot when I was driving around among the polling places. I pulled the car over to the side and said to myself, maybe I should write a different kind of speech. That evening, the radio station was reporting the tallies as they came in. And after they were all through, write-ins have had 53% of the vote. But what did they write in? Mickey Mouse could be written in just as well as my name. And how would they have spelled my name, even if they meant to write in Sally? Thank goodness my parents and my husband hadn't given me a difficult name. But had we made it too simple with our just write in Sally? Were there going to be people who just wrote in Sally? And would that count? So we all felt good about the 53%, but we weren't sure. And it took until the Board of Elections meeting the next afternoon. They went through every single vote that the Election Day workers had laboriously recorded. For example, did Sally with an IE count? In the end, they tossed 15 votes that were extraneous, but 2,238 voters did a splendid job of getting my name right. Another 63 put it into the wrong place, because remember I said you had to pull over the little door. They had to pull over door number 5. Well, who knew? So a lot of people pulled over the wrong door. So I almost got elected to the Soil and Water Conservation District. That didn't count. Strangely enough, just a little quirk, but one person wrote in the name of the person who was actually on the ballot, and they had a long time to decide whether it counted if you wrote in the other name. So I think in the end they decided not, but I thought that was a rather strange dilemma to have. The Senior Statesman Board suggests I talk about what changed over these last 16 years, since that's what I've been on the board. When I was elected 16 years ago, people who were concerned about how this community is growing really only had the choice to say yes or no to a development. There was nothing in between. And yet, some development can be a good thing. How were you to distinguish between development? And were you only going to be able to say no to everything? So a major constructive change in those 16 years is that it's no longer yes or no. That sounds simple, but it took years of effort. The change that made it possible to build a consensus on when everyone could say yes to a development was, with a great deal of public and industry input, a thing that we call the neighborhood model. When development sprawls across the countryside, it damages the earth, requires more miles of driving, it's more expensive for the residents, and is generally worse than compact development. But compact sounds a lot like slums, or something that a lot of people moved away from in big cities. So how could we have compact development that was attractive to the developer, attractive to the prospective homeowner or renter, lay lightly on the land, didn't put too much stress on people already living here, and would remain a place to live healthily and happily for the long term? It wouldn't be the cheapest way to develop, but what we came up with is almost exactly what industry analysts such as the Urban Land Institute say is the best way for developers to prosper in the long run. The old sprawl way to develop was gone, but a number of local developers participated in the creation of this thing called the neighborhood model and set to work to build new neighborhoods, not just new developments. If there are sidewalks and there are places worth reaching that are within walking distance, if children can safely walk to their friends and to their school, if handicapped people and frail people can get outside and or watch the neighbors from their porch, if you don't have to get out onto a major highway for every shopping trip, if the buildings are a comfortable scale so they don't overpower you when you stand near them, if you can bet then that it matches our neighborhood model. Low impact development is a more recent term, but our own homegrown model has much in common with what's called new urbanism. It was brand new in 1997, and it took 5 years before it was developed into law. Biscuit Run was going to be the best example of the neighborhood model community. Okay, some of you wonder why not everyone was jumping up in joy at Biscuit Run becoming a state park. But for a long time, county's development had been designated to be inside a designated area for growth. There was to be an area where growth and development was encouraged and leave the rest rural. Instead of the constant sprawl that you see in Northern Virginia or Chesterfield County, for example, there are over 30 square miles designated for development. The rest of the 723 square miles are open for farming and forestry, with houses being the exception rather than the expected. I think I can do this. I only have one visual here, but this is Albemarle County. It's 723 square miles. The hole in the middle is Charlottesville, 10 square miles. The development area, so this is the Charlottesville, so this is 29 North, 250 East to Glenmore, 250 West to Crozet. These are the boundaries of our development area. It's 5% of the county, or about 35 square miles. And into that is encouraged development. Thirty square miles is three times as big as Charlottesville, so it's hardly a squeeze play. 30 square miles is too big to have good transit system throughout, but it's better than the alternative sprawl of subdivisions scattered more than we have already. The edges are defined on this official map, and business zoning stops at the boundaries. Main way the county enforces the boundaries in addition to zoning is by not extending water and sewer beyond the boundaries, which is a great savings to all of you who, one way or the other, are paying for the water infrastructure. If you want to have anything approaching compact development where the efficiency is the greatest, we should think very carefully before expanding those boundaries. We have almost 14 square miles of vacant, undeveloped land sitting within those boundaries, much of it already zoned for development. And this is taking into account Biscuit Run's change into a state park, not counting it. Those 14 square miles are more land than the whole area covered by Charlottesville. It's just sitting there vacant. So I would encourage you, don't believe it when developers say they need more land. What they probably need is for some land they personally just happen to own and would like to develop, but that sits beyond those boundary lines. We today have already approved zoning for over 13,000 homes that are not yet built. Again, this is deleting Biscuit Run. The city has almost 4,000 in the pipeline for a total of over 17,000 homes, which is enough for 40,000 more people than we have today, or doubling Charlottesville's population, or about the population growth expected in the county to the year 2030, without a single new rezoning or a single additional acre. That's not taking into account the increased density suggested by some for the city or any homes built in the rural area. There are also 2.5 million square feet of commercial and retail space already zoned and ready to go, but not started. That is more zoned, empty commercial property than the city has today, and almost half again as much as being used today in the county. Other changes in those years are easier to describe and won't take me so long. But one is a restriction on commercial lighting. You may not have thought about it, but dark skies are something that we can all treasure and that we're losing throughout the country. We have an ordinance that requires all new commercial lighting to have a cap on top so that no extraneous light goes up into the sky. So you can see the stars a lot better in Alamo County than you would otherwise expect, being as close as we are to developed area. Charlottesville has been a lot slower in developing such an ordinance, and a lot of such ordinances exempt sports lighting. So even if we do a perfect job in the county, we still are impacting our skies with a lot of playing fields and the kind of lights that blare up from them. But compared to most places, we've done a good job. We also have a program for buying a farmer's development potential from the land so that the farms that we see and enjoy, if they want to sell their development potential, the county will buy it and the family farm can continue to thrive. It's called the ACE program, Acquisition of Conservation Easements. It's what ACE stands for. And it's been very successful and, in fact, has managed to save some family farms. We have what we call a wireless communication policy that you may not be aware of. If you compare us to most communities and get to noticing, you'll realize that you don't see many cell phone towers. You see some. They're usually the old ones that were built a long time ago. We have over 100 cell phone towers in this county, and I challenge you to find more than 5 or 6 because they're treetop, they look like telephone poles, and they don't have the array of cell panels that you usually see. They're up against the pole, and we had to take our decision to have that kind of policy all the way to the Federal Court of Appeals, but we won. So we have the best cell phone tower policy that you'll find most anywhere. A lot of other places have come to see what it is we've done. We have more protection of our water resources than we had 16 years ago. Every single creek in our county is protected from having a house or a road built so close to it that it pollutes the water for anyone downstream. We're not perfect in our water protection, but we're doing better than most counties. We have an affordable housing policy. Every new subdivision is challenged to build 15% of its units to be affordable. And there is a definition of that. Some people laugh and say, oh, what's affordable for you might not be for me. But it means that a family that's 80% of the region's poverty level in their income can afford a mortgage to buy the house. Creation of this policy was made through a citizens advisory committee that included housing developers sitting on it. As soon as it was agreed to, a developer who had been on the committee came forward with a subdivision plan that met the new standard, thus proving that it could be done and keeping us out of court, which other counties that have tried this kind of policy end up in court, but ours has not been challenged. And I think it's largely because we had a committee that included people in the housing industry, and they came forward right away to show that it could be done. We have many, many bragging points about our schools. Rather than going into them, I might say that if you're interested in, you know, how are our schools doing, you used to have to depend on your niece's neighbor's third cousin to tell you how her child was doing, and that was about the only way you knew to see what was going on in the schools. But you can just plug into K-12 Albemarle schools, and they have a report card on themselves, and you can see how they're doing. The fastest growing section of our budget, and certainly a change from 16 years ago, is fire and rescue. We always had volunteer fire and rescue companies, and places like Morton's Frozen Food would let everybody run out the door when the fire alarm went off, and you'd rush off to the fire. And you just can't find that kind of employer anymore. So we're beginning to have paid firefighters, and that's the fastest growing segment in our budget. I also count the 16 years as a time when we tried some things that didn't work. We tried to protect our mountaintops from ostentatious development. And as you can see, if you look towards the chain of hills that include Monticello, we failed. Someday, there may be just enough ugliness on our mountaintops that people will decide to pass a protective ordinance. Or the ugliness will creep up on us and we won't notice until we get used to it, and then it'll be too late. We had two mountaintop protection committees of citizens who worked for years, but we failed to win enough votes on the Board of Supervisors to pass anything. Our budget has grown over those years. As a lot of people have pointed out, it's grown more than a population plus inflation would suggest. The main expense in local government is the salaries of its employees. We have more competitive salaries than we did 16 years ago, and we've made more complex demands on teachers and others. We have very few more staff per capita, so it's not growth in the numbers especially. Firemen that I mentioned are a total growth from 0 to 80, but per capita it's changed from about 6 per 1,000 capita to about 6.2 per 1,000 capita. And that includes the change in fire. If you exclude the firemen, the number of staff in the general government is almost identical per 1,000 capita. But we invested in our staff to provide salaries at the medium of similar employers. We have a list that we compare ourselves to that goes from Buckingham County to Prince William and includes some local employers like Martha Jefferson Hospital. I think we've done a good thing for the community by having more competitive salaries, because it's one of the rare examples of a rising tide raising all boats, because when our salaries are competitive, it means other employers have to have competitive salaries, and it means that our employees and more people can afford to live here and buy retail products here. We have also become much more sophisticated in how we look at our budget, and particularly our salaries. I can remember in the 1980s when I was on the school board that a school's budget was determined by their friendship level between the principal and the superintendent. We're not like that anymore. And we made investments in our buildings over those years. Monticello High School, I was very proud to be on the advisory committee that helped shape that school. And if you've never walked in it, I really encourage you to. It's a wonderful, light, airy school that was built on principles at that point had only been proven in industry, which was that people in industry demonstrably did a better job when they had daylight. And since then, it's been proven many places in schools too, but that building was a leader in the principle. So to look at the years to come, which your board asked me to do, I'll just mention a few things. But for one, we're going to be a military town. You already see battle, I call them battle fatigues, but I don't know, anyway, they're uniform, but they're very distinctive, and you see military people about town. 800 or 1,000 men and women will be added to their number in the next 2 years. This, of course, will lead to more 29 North development as they settle in and more retail purchases. Our economy will take care of itself if growth in population is a cure-all. I'm looking at Jack. He doesn't like that statement. Green County is also counting on a boost to its economy. Then, of course, you'll have more traffic, school children numbers, and trailing spouses. The University of Virginia already is concerned about their trailing spouses. I don't know if that's a term you're used to, but you can picture what it is. And so you're going to have possibly a boost in our unemployment rolls because you're going to have spouses who don't have jobs who come to town with their military family. I think that we'll value the University of Virginia all the more if we're smart. Wonder why we don't have the unemployment of other communities. Notice who is still building, still employing people. Our main employer hasn't left town. I predict we're going to get tired of our roads and traffic. Will we get tired enough to tell our state legislators that we won't vote them out of office if they vote to make us pay for better roads? So far, we as a state have not. The funding for road maintenance and construction has dropped so dramatically that, well, one little example, we won't have any money to pave any rural roads for at least 6 years. So a couple of things to worry about. Will we get more ugly? One of the things that keeps us less ugly than, say, Route 3 coming out of Fredericksburg, Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania County have slightly less population than we. So why is their road so ugly, and why is 29 North not? We love to poke fun at 29 North, but if you really look at it as you drive along, it's not an ugly place. So Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania County have no entrance corridor or corridor, no entrance corridor ordinance, no architecture review board, obviously not much of a sign ordinance. All those are factors that can be changed by our Board of Supervisors. We can turn 29 North into a Route 3 fairly easily. No businesses like to be told what kind of sign to put up, I suspect. But I also suspect each business is very glad that every other business has its signs and lights controlled. It creates a level playing field in a rare area. Usually it's the biggest, baddest sign that catches your eye and, for some people, pulls you in to buy a hamburger there instead of someplace else, until the next business decides it needs even a bigger and badder sign. Businesses as a whole can be harmed by doing what a few businesses loudly request. If you care about the fragile beauty of our state, if you want your memories of beautiful state to be what your grandchildren will see, I recommend that you look into joining an organization that takes that charge seriously. An Active Garden Club, Scenic Virginia, League of Women Voters. Sometimes it takes groups to speak up for the natural beauty and willingness to protect it. Will we become more energy efficient? Albemarle and Charlottesville are on the way of becoming leaders in their own energy usage. The public buildings have won Energy Star designation, and we've won national competitions among other counties in how well we're doing in our energy savings. That's just for the public buildings, but soon you'll be hearing more about how to make your own homes and businesses more energy efficient. The programs require leadership and willingness to have a staff devoted to the issue. Will we become better stewards of our water resources? We have miles and miles of impaired streams, meaning the pollution is stressing out the water quality. So far, as you all probably know, we're killing the Chesapeake Bay. It has a dead spot in the middle of it where the oxygen is so low that neither plants nor animals can live. Our water ends up in the James River and then to the Chesapeake Bay, and you're going to be hearing more in the next 2 years. The EPA is going to force us to clean up our waters better than we're doing now. When we hired a company to do a citizen survey of Albemarle County some years ago, and perhaps you've received the phone calls for that survey over the years, I asked the people putting together the survey, what makes Albemarle County different? What have you seen here that you haven't seen elsewhere? And they said, without hesitation, Albemarle County residents care about natural resources in a way that's rare. So just keep expressing that care. Will we continue to be leaders in education, both at the school, college, and university level? As a nation, we're in grave danger if we don't take seriously the need to have an educated citizenry, workforce, and researchers. Our school system told us at a joint retreat 2 years ago, interesting little fact, China is so large in its population that just the top 10% of the kids graduating from Chinese high schools is the same number as all of our graduates in a year. Put another way, our top 10 is only one-tenth the size of their top 10. We've got to be educating all of our students, not just our top 10, if we're going to be internationally competitive. And the people sitting in this room have a major part in that, because we don't have children in the schools anymore, and we may not think that we need to care for the next generation's education. If children in Albemarle County can't get a good education, where in the country are they going to get a good education? We do tend to care about our education. I think eat local is a very interesting trend that we can watch. But how about also supporting our local retailers? And are we going to do that? Or are we just going to let Main Street die and just shop by computer? Delight in bringing in new businesses, or are we going to support our present ones? Since in retail, at least, the new sought-after businesses are usually national chains, it's often damaging to the local businesses when the new ones come in. Are we going to be protective or forget the local guys in the fun of bragging about something new come to town? Some economists think creativity is going to be the key to a sustainable economy in the next decade. Local businesses are best at growing local employment, and they're good at local creativity, too, whether carrying a new line of clothing or developing a new apple. But they need to know they have a market, and that's where the buy local is going to be crucial. Will we continue to be a well-run, efficient government? When compared to other governments in Virginia, we run our government on less cost per average, per capita. For example, we run our parks and recreation programs for $67, while Charlottesville spends $251, and James City County, which is one that we often compare ourselves to, spends $171. We look at these figures every year and compare ourselves, but you might be interested to know that we're the smallest county in the nation to have a AAA bond rating. Will we continue to be a good place to live? I have three pages of superlatives that we've gotten in the magazines and newspapers in recent years. Top 10 lists are something that weren't all that common 16 years ago, so we can't really compare ourselves through the years. But we are considered the best place to raise a family, a place to live, to retire, to be healthy, whatever that means, to bicycle, to relocate, to be alive, to take a weekend escape, to launch a business, to work, to do business, to have a job, to golf, play tennis. Anyway, it goes on and on. And one of my favorites is to drink wine. We've been on all those top 10 lists. We regularly win awards for our programs in the county government and for our greenness, our historic preservation, our use of information technology, and our explanation of our budget to the public. Our rural area is a jewel that is not pleasant, not only pleasant to the eye, but also places for those future agricultural products. 60% is in forest land, which we sometimes don't think about when we think about our rural area. And those forest lands are our best protector of water quality. So I'm going to end up talking about infiltration just once more. Only this time, it's a technical term that you may not be acquainted with. It goes along with the word inflow. So let me explain. Flow of sewage we're now talking about. Flow of sewage should be the same, rain or shine. If a sewage treatment plant is overflowing when there's rain, then the sewage carrying pipes must be spongy, or rain gutters must be connected to the sewer lines. If there are illegal attachments, it's called inflow. If the pipes are spongy, it's called infiltration. So, an entirely different use of the term. But if you leave today just remembering that one term, I hope it will ring a small bell of alarm in your head. When pipes get old and spongy, they absorb so much rainwater that the sewage treatment plant, manhole covers, can overflow. with raw sewage mixed in with the rainwater. It destroys the possibility of wildlife living in the downstreams, and practically speaking, it can get us heavy fines. Our country is allowing its infrastructure to crumble everywhere. Many bridges, sewers, wastewater facilities, and other infrastructure in the U.S. were built during the Great Suburban Expansion in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. They were not built to last longer than 50 years and are now approaching the end of their lifespans. 5 years ago, the American Society of Civil Engineers concluded that 27% of the almost 600,000 bridges in the U.S. are structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. The report estimated it would cost U.S. $9 billion annually for 20 years to fix the bridges alone. Now, I often think of our old house that we live in. It was built around 1830, and we spend constantly time putting on new gutters and painting it and putting insulation in the cellar, and I'm getting tired of doing all the things that hold up the house, but nothing's new, shiny, or catches your eye when you visit us. And that's what infrastructure is, and that's how we're all feeling about our country. We like the new, shiny things, but you know, once a bridge is up, ribbon cut, then it's supposed to last forever. Sewer lines are even less appealing than bridges to spend any time or money on. We're either going to have to elect officials who are willing to push funds into infrastructure and give them our tax dollars for capital projects, including maintenance of existing infrastructure, or we're going to deteriorate to the point of danger. And then we'll make spot rescue jobs when it's more expensive. The water supply plan that is such an item of controversy in our community right now, about 60% of that is simply taking care of crumbling pipes and a 100-year-old bridge dam that wasn't trustworthy when it was built. So a lot of this is in our hands. The state of Virginia limits what local government can do. We're called a Dillon Rule state as opposed to a Home Rule state. But we elect those state legislators and we elect our local legislators. So most of these questions are not in the hands of outside forces. If Pogo famously said, "We have met the enemy and he is us," I'd like to end on sort of a corny but more hopeful note and point out we've also met the voters and they is us. So go forth and create good government.
Sally, thank you so much. I think all of us understand now why Charlottesville and Albemarle County are such a wonderful place to live in. When you have this type of leadership that she's given us for 16 years, this is why we're here, folks. So, we'd like to open it up to questions, and Sally's been nice enough to agree to answer your questions. And so we've got people with microphones, and we have to all, because we're doing a podcast of all of our meetings, we need you, when you ask your question, to get a microphone from either Bill or Jim and use the microphone.
Sally, excluding the financial aspect that we're currently in, what, from your perspective, do you foresee as the solution to the bypass issue?
The Western Bypass has appeared on a national list of most stupid boondoggles for years. It would take care of the through traffic, but it wouldn't raise our existing intersections on 29 above a level of F that's failing. So we would still be stuck in our local traffic. The Lynchburg folks would be getting their trucks straight on through, and they would be really happy about that. But it would leave us with a failed transportation system because only 10% of the traffic is going through. The rest is local traffic. That wasn't quite the answer you wanted. But there's a thing called Places 29, which is being discussed probably this morning at the Board of Supervisors, in fact. It's a rather unique attempt to put together land use planning and transportation planning. Because usually, You have people who study the transportation flow of what it is today, and they suggest, well, if you put maybe 10% more cars on, it'll be like this in 10 years, and so we'll give you these figures about this road, and you ought to widen it. And then other people are saying, well, how do we want our neighborhoods, and how do we want to live, and where do we want the neighborhoods to go, and where's the best place to have the shopping? And usually those two groups are not necessarily talking to each other at all. And so you have plans for nice wide roads that don't take into account the fact that you might have a school, well, this is an exaggeration, but you might have a school on one side and all the children on the other side. It's that kind of planning that Places 29 is trying to break down and say, why don't we plan for where we're going to have growth and development at the same time as we're looking at our road? And they're proposing some grade-separated interchanges that are a fascinating engineering device. They're not the usual clover leaf. They're a one way over and then another way back. Can't explain it going through the air like this, but it's a way to get intersections that local people can actually use to get to places back and forth on 29 North without clogging up the highway with stoplights that are the bane of everyone's existence on both sides, or with great, huge, heavy, multi-lane interchanges that look like a aircraft carrier sort of thing. So I think it's come up with some brilliant suggestions of how to both plan our growth and plan a through highway, because that highway is in some ways our main street, but it's also a state national highway, and we have to figure out how to do both those things. And it's taken several years for Places 29 to work out the proposal. And I hope that you all will go to the public hearings and see what you think of it.
Yes, Sally, I would like to first of all congratulate you on 16 years of survival and being able to accomplish all the things that you have. I had a question about the infrastructure, which seems to be pushed to the bottom of everybody's list, both nationally, statewide, and locally. Within the problems of infrastructure, how much does Albemarle County rely on funding from the state or the federal government, and how much of it must be done by the county itself? Do you have any statistics on that?
Can't give you flat figures, but I can give you a general answer. A lot of states, the state provides the money, for example, for local schools. Virginia doesn't do that. So most of our infrastructure is dependent on local ratepayers when it comes to water and sewer, or local taxpayers when it comes to our buildings. So we're very much dependent on our local sources. The shovel-ready projects that were supposed to get some federal funding, most of that's not come through, and we certainly have some shovel-ready projects. If ever federal government decides to open that pot again, maybe they'll work it differently. But in fact, it didn't turn out to be much of an infrastructure payer in our community, at least. Did help the schools somewhat and help the state with some of its expenses. But mostly it has to be local, and so we have bonds, and so we have debts, and so we have interest rates to pay, because it's almost all local. Great question. Thank you.
Hi. I'm just wondering about the water supply. Are we going to go with the Ragged Mountain Dam or the what we have, or a pipe underneath and all that? What's going to happen?
Yeah. Well, I'm not good at predicting what's going to happen. I would have 2 years ago thought I knew what was going to happen. But let me use the map for something. Our water system today consists of the Rivanna Reservoir and a reservoir up at Sugar Hollow and a reservoir at Ragged Mountain. The reservoir up at Sugar Hollow was built about 1920, and there's a pipe that goes and carries water to the Charlottesville Reservoir. It's, if you can do your math, 80 or 90 years old. The water from the Mormons and the Meachams and the Ivy Creek go into the Rivanna Reservoir. And this will continue to be our drinking water source forever. It's a very good river. It has a lot of flow to it. It also has a watershed that includes a huge portion of the county. And whenever you have a big watershed, you get the soil washing off of it. And so it's getting the silt that every time you put a dam across a river, you get silt. And we have a big watershed, so we're getting a lot of silt. This dam was built around the turn of the last century, and it was suspect when it was built. The engineer wrote letters about how it hadn't been built to his specifications, and dams of that type started failing about 20 years later. And so they put concrete on the upper side and piled some more dirt on the bottom side. That dirt is wet when tested by engineers today, meaning water is coming through the dam. So the state has told us we've got to fix that dam. We've got to do something serious with it. We can't just widen the spillway, which is very narrow. You'd have to widen it to 250 feet in order to meet state standards for the reservoir of that size. So looking at the crumbling dam, the state said, why don't you make better use of this reservoir? It's a good reservoir. It's never going to silt in. It's not blocking up a major river. Why don't you make use? Why don't you enlarge that reservoir? So people in the community were very concerned that if we didn't figure out a way to get water locally, we were going to go to the James. And whether it was a prejudice or whether it was rational, we didn't really like the idea of going to the James. And, you know, we were all talking about Lynchburg's the city that has that problem with its sewage, isn't it? And do we really want to be downriver? And, you know, it was a very strong feeling that we wanted to do something locally. So how could we make use of a very good reservoir here with a crumbling dam? Good water flow here, but a silting in reservoir. An old reservoir up in Sugar Hollow, and yet stay local. The answer came out in some public meetings, because there were dozens of public meetings held, and someone said, wouldn't it be nice if you could connect these two? Well, indeed you could. So it's that pipeline that takes advantage of all the best characteristics of our system and takes care of the major problem. So you use the water that is in full flow in this river. You, in full flow periods, pipe some of it, to a reservoir that you've enlarged because you've taken care of the crumbling dam that's there. Crumbling is overstating it. It's not crumbling. It's an inadequate dam, and it's leaking. And then you let the Sugar Hollow Reservoir continue to exist, but you don't pipe water from there to here. So you take care of this 90-year-old pipe that is leaking, and the rights of way are not owned or known on all of it. It would be a nightmare to try to dig it up and repair it. You put a new pipeline, which, you know, pipelines are being put in all over the country. You put a new pipeline connecting your best source and your best storage. You settle out this water before you pipe it, so you're not piping silt into the Ragged Mountain Reservoir. And you end up with a system that's local, which means we're going to continue to care about our watershed, and is using all the best characteristics of a water system that's in our county. We're very lucky. We don't have anyone else to blame if our water system or our watershed is allowed to go to ruin. It's all in our county.
Going back to the question on infrastructure, you said that the federal stimulus money hadn't been of much help. But don't I recall correctly, a couple of months ago, the administrator of the federal stimulus program sent a relatively stern letter to the governor of Virginia, pointing out that Virginia was 50 amongst 50 states in actually using the stimulus money for things. Do you understand what was going on with that?
No, I don't. I remember that there was a an article afterwards that the state was kind of explaining what it was up to, but I don't remember. I thought maybe you would.
Well, I recently had my driveway paved, and I had S.L. Williamson do it, which is a huge company which loves to do highway paving and so forth and so on. And I said, how's the stimulus money affecting you? And they said, there's not a dollar of it anywhere. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know that some of the things that have happened, a lot of the stimulus money was used to help with Medicaid, which is such a growing entitlement that that's where the state ended up using some of their stimulus money. I know that for road projects, everyone's being encouraged to use to develop projects that can be funded with federal money. So it is about the only place that there's money for roads. But it didn't end up being the cure-all for shovel-ready projects that we had hoped.
Your successor, Dwayne Snow, who won in your district for supervisor, has proposed what he calls zero budgeting for the county of Albemarle. And I believe on that subject matter, he actually won the election. What do you foresee the efficacy of zero budgeting? And I can explain what that jargon term apparently means. Zero budgeting means that you throw out rationalization for any amount of money spent in the past, and you justify every dollar spent in every department, salary, and so on.
Well, I actually did a little research and went on the internet, like everyone does when they have a question, to see about zero-based budgeting. And it's not, in fact, used very much. It was a very popular theme back in the 1970s, and it never really has caught on. But in theory, it is starting with zero. And then the police chief comes in and says, I would like one policeman. And then you say, okay, one. Two, well, okay, two. So you start at absolute zero, and you work your way up. All the departments in the county have been asked to say what of their projects are mandated, and we have many mandated programs in the county. We also have, of course, debt payments and things that we are mandated to do. And then they're asked, so what are you mandated to do? What has appeared high on citizen surveys, and what is very important for you to do, and what is sort of a nicety. I don't know the exact terms they're asked to fill out, but I know they're going through that process. And I think that that is probably as close as you're going to get to zero-based budgeting at this point. And I think it'll be an interesting project and an interesting budgeting period. In our community, the term let's do what we need and not what we want is kind of an interesting term, because in this community, we want a good school system. So is that a need or is that a want? We want to take good care of our natural resources. Is that a need or is that a want? So I think the budgeting period is going to be very interesting if they actually get down to distinguishing between needs and wants. And I would just encourage you all to keep a watch on it and go to the public hearings and speak up. You may have wants. You might want to have jaunt continue so that people can be picked up at their homes. Is that a need? It's not mandated. and we could very easily stop the rural rides that Jaunt provides right now. That's a local program. So it's budgeting is always a time to think about what kind of local government, and I'm going to use the word want, what kind of local government you want, what kind of local programs you want. It's going to be, you know, it's always those kind of questions. There's nothing new about asking them. They're asked every year. And I just encourage you to pay attention to what is being talked about.
Thank you again for all of your 16 years. If Jaunt closed, it would definitely affect the senior center. It drives by here 20 or 30 times a day. So please don't do that. My question is concerning the rescue squad and charging for ambulance service. How is that going to affect our rescue squads, and is it really going to bring the money in, and is it going to raise our cost for our insurance?
Your insurance fees are already assuming that you get charged for ambulance rides. The other communities, and many other communities have done this, have not found that their community contributions, their volunteers, decrease in numbers, but that is something that people are certainly concerned about. It's money that in some senses is sitting out there. Any community that wants to charge for their ambulance rides can do so, and insurance and Medicare and Medicaid pay for it. And so when you're looking at not raising your taxes, you start looking at fees and other sources of money, and that's a source of money. I had to be talked into it personally because it was very easy for me to picture someone sitting at home bleeding to death or having a heart attack, saying, I can't afford the ambulance ride, don't call the rescue squad. I could just so easily picture that I was really concerned about our charging for ambulance rides. One of the things that influenced me in thinking that this was okay is today, when you take an ambulance ride, you are charged. The hospital is charging you for the medicines that you use. And if you're not getting medicines, you're not on the ambulance. So you're already, your insurance company is already paying for your ambulance ride in the sense that it's paying for the medicines. So it's not a new system in that sense. It's just adding the fee for the miles and the ride. I think we'll sort of see how it works. And I hope no one here or lets their friends think that they mustn't call the rescue squad because they can't afford it. We made very sure that we wouldn't, that we would have what's called a compassionate billing system. The insurance companies force you to try to collect, so you have to send a bill, but you don't have to hound someone. And that's what other communities have done also, is had what they call a compassionate billing system. You know, we could raise your taxes and then wouldn't have to. But in fact, our fire and rescue systems have become quite an expensive part of our budget.
In today's paper, it said that they will not refuse to pick up anybody. So I don't know. I hate to add that if you hadn't read about it. But so I don't think people need to worry.
But I think people probably are going to worry, and I think you all can help, actually, to assure people that they are going to be picked up, they will be sent a bill, they won't be hounded, and their insurance is going to pay for it, and their Medicare.
We're on the downside of the housing bubble, and the real estate values that had peaked probably, you know, 3 or 4 years ago are coming down. Did you receive any information before your term ended as to projections as to where the real estate valuation will go? Because that's what will dictate the revenues that are available through the property tax.
Yeah, they're assumed it's still going down. The total revenues from the real estate tax are assuming to fall or be level. And they do keep track pretty closely and report to the, well, certainly to the county executive and to the Board of Supervisors. So even by the time I had my last meeting in December, we had had a couple of projections, and they were all going downwards. 2 years ago, commercial values were not particularly hit, but now they have been. So residential values may be going down slightly, and commercial values going down quite a bit. And it's because the values are going down that the discussion was, shall we keep the tax rate the same or the tax bill the same? Because if your assessment has gone down and the tax rate goes up slightly, your bill would still stay even. And that's the discussion difference between the 77 cents and the 74 cents. 74, essentially, is what we have now. 77 is what would keep the residential tax bill for most people at a level.
The question was approximately what percentage of the county taxes go towards maintaining our schools. As an educator, when I hear people talk about lowering people's taxes, I think, oh my word, that's going to hit schools hard.
Well, it's about 60%. That includes the debt payment for school buildings, but it's about 60% of our budget goes to the schools. And so, of course, when the whole budget or the whole revenue picture falls, the schools will too. The state had told us about a month ago that their contribution to county schools was going to fall by $6 million. But Kane's budget doesn't have that happening, so everyone's going to be watching the General Assembly very closely to see what they do with the amount of money that they're putting into education.
Hi, Sally. We really thank you for all the things you have done for Albemarle County these last 16 years, especially in the fields of natural resources, preserving our lands and our water supply, and also in the fields of education. And I wondered, in the field of education, I just read in the paper this past week of statistics that about one-fourth of the students in U.S. schools now are either immigrants or children of recent immigrants. What is the impact on Albemarle schools?
Let's see if I have something here that gives a number for that. I thought maybe I did. No, shoot, I don't. I'm sorry. I remember a figure about Greer Elementary School having something like 30 languages that were the home languages of the children in that school. But some of those are from University of Virginia families or researchers or graduate students. So when we talk about our foreign language problems, they're not always the same as what immediately comes to mind as the stereotype. As to Hispanic students, we do have a growing number of Hispanic or Spanish-speaking students. We used to have such students mostly in immigrant camps, and we would send social workers and educators out trying to help the kids so they'd get a little education while they were here. A lot of those families a few years ago started living here, not traveling around, so children are actually getting a better education. And then the economy hit, and I think that it's been kind of an equal employment opportunity. I think it's hit every sector of the economy. So I don't have figures for this year as to what the level of the Hispanic students are. I know that in the whole county government, a lot of people are trying to learn Spanish. School secretaries are taking courses in Spanish, and so are people in other departments. And we're trying to make sure that we aren't disregarding people because of their inability to speak English. But I don't think it's become a major problem in the sense that some communities talk about it. It's more a matter of bringing some interesting diversity into our schools rather than any sort of problem. And there's a group called Creciendo Juntos, which deals with the Hispanic issues in our community. If anyone's really interested in that, I would encourage you. They have monthly meetings that are very interesting. So it's not something that people are ignoring. They're trying to meet it head on and see what both the opportunities and the issues are.
Sally, it's hard to imagine you hanging up your spurs entirely. What kinds of activities do you have ahead of you for the foreseeable future?
Well, I have four other boards that I sit on, so I'm going to keep my interest in those. One of them is the Chesapeake Bay Local Government Advisory Committee. So we try to get EPA to pay attention to local governments when it comes down with requirements for us to clean up our water, but we also try to help local governments recognize that responsibility. And I'm also on, I'll just go ahead and tell you because they are kind of a diverse group. I'm on the AIDS support group, ASG, which deals with the AIDS epidemic and does a lot of preventive work so that we try to keep the numbers from growing in our community. You all would be shocked at the fact that there are sex workers in our community and people who are making their way through college by selling their bodies. It's pretty interesting things that most of us are far too sheltered to be aware of. So I'm on that board. A totally fun one is the Lewis and Clark Exploratory Center. Someday we'll have a building on the near Dardentau Park that will help kids learn a lot more about why we call ourselves where the Lewis and Clark expedition started. And the third one is Scenic Virginia. One of my passions is the visual beauty of this state. I grew up in Oregon. It would be hard to ruin Mount Hood, but it's not very hard to ruin the Ragged Mountains. And so I pay a lot of attention to what we do, try to keep this place attractive in all ways. So thanks for the question.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.